This was her life. Until Rex. Until more gunfire. Until Hank. Through the window, she can see the devastation on Knapp's face. It is the first time she has seen him in 15 years. Her life's greatest what-if. The road not taken. She lets the emotions ricochet through her. She doesn't fight them. At one point, she even steps out from the shadows. She stands under a light in the parking lot, in plain view now, not moving, letting fate take the chance that Knapp might turn and look out the diner window and see her, and then... She gives him 10 seconds to look. Nothing. She gives him another 10. But Knapp never looks out the window. Maura turns and disappears back into the night. Chapter 23. Diana and I had plans, Ellie begins. There are only 2 other tables of patrons left, and they are way on the other side of the counter. I'm trying hard to not get ahead of myself, to listen before jumping to conclusions, to absorb first and process later. We probably seemed like silly clichés looking back on it. I was president of the student council, Diana was vice president. We were co-captains of the soccer team. Our parents were close friends. They'd go out to dinner as a foursome. She looks up at me. Does Augie date much?
Not really.
You said he went down south with a girlfriend recently.
Yvonne, Hilton Head.
Is that in Georgia?
It's an island off South Carolina.
How did it go?
Ellie asks. How did Augie put it? I don't think it's going to work out.
I'm sorry to hear that.
I say nothing.
He should be with someone. Diana wouldn't want her father alone like that.
I catch Bunny's eyes, but she looks away, giving us privacy. Someone has hit one of the old jukeboxes. Tears for Fears remind us in song that everybody wants to rule the world. You said you saw Maura before Leo and Diana died, I say, trying to get us back on course.
I'm getting to that.
I wait.
So Diana and I are in the school library. You probably don't remember this, no reason you would. But we had our big fall dance coming up the week after. Diana was head of the planning committee. I was her second.
She's right, I don't remember. The annual fall dance. Maura wouldn't have wanted to go. I wouldn't have cared.
I'm not telling this right, Ellie says. It's okay. Anyway, the dance was a big deal to Diana. She'd been working on it over a month. She couldn't decide between 2 themes. One was Vintage Boardwalk. The other was called Once Upon a Storybook. And so Diana suggested that we do both. Ellie looks off now, a small smile toying with her lips. I was adamantly against this idea. I told Diana we have to pick only one because otherwise it would be anarchy. And because I was a stupid, pathetic little perfectionist, this, what theme to choose, is what my best friend and I argued about the last time we ever spoke.
Ellie stops. I give her the time to put herself back together.
So we're arguing about this, and it's getting kind of heated. And then Maura walks in and starts talking to Diana. I was in a snit about the idea of 2 themes, and so I didn't listen to the first part too closely, but Maura wanted Diana to come with her somewhere that night. Diana said no, that she kind of had it.
Had it with what, I ask?
She didn't say. But then Diana told us both something.
Ellie stops again and looks at me. What, I say.
She said that she'd had it with the whole group of them.
And by group she meant...
Look, I didn't really care. I was focused on how someone could possibly think you could have 2 themes for 1 dance, and how would you possibly mesh Vintage Boardwalk, which I liked, with carnival games and peanuts and popcorn, with Once Upon a Storybook, which I didn't even get. I mean, what the hell does that even mean? But now, after what we saw in the yearbook, I guess maybe Diana was talking about the conspiracy club. I don't know.
That's not the part you won't like.
What is the part I won't like?
What Diana said next.
Which was?
Diana wanted to wait another couple of weeks, until after the fall dance, because, well, she was the planning chair, but Diana said she was tired of your brother and his friends. She swore us both to secrecy. But she said she was going to break up with Leo.
I just react. That's crap.
Now it's Ellie's turn to stay quiet.
Diana and Leo were solid, I say. I mean, yeah, it was high school, but
he changed, Nap.
I shake my head.
Leo was moodier, that's what Diana said. He would snap at her. Look, a lot of kids were experimenting senior year, partying or whatever.
That's all he was doing, too. Leo was fine.
No, Nap, he wasn't fine.
We lived in the same room. I knew everything about him.
And yet you didn't know what was going on with the conspiracy club.
You didn't know he and Diana were having a rough time of it.
That's not your fault. You had Mora and your hockey. You were just a kid.
Her voice trails off when she sees my face.
Whatever happened that night, Ellie begins.
I interrupt her. What do you mean, whatever happened? That military base was guarding a secret. Leo and Mora and, I don't know, the rest of them found out what it is. I don't care if Leo was stoned, or that maybe Diana considered breaking up with him a week later. They all saw something. I have the proof now.
I know, Ellie says gently. I'm on your side.
You don't sound like it.
Nap?
I look at her.
Maybe you should let this go, she finally says.
Yeah, that's not gonna happen.
Maybe Mora doesn't want to be found.
I'm not doing this for Mora, I say. I'm doing this for Leo. But once we are out in the parking lot, once I kiss Ellie's cheek and make sure she's in her car, a thought rises from the ashes and won't so easily be put down.
Maybe Ellie is right.
Maybe I should let this go. I watch Ellie pull out. She doesn't turn around and wave goodbye. She's always waved goodbye in the past. Dumb thing to notice, but there you go. I wonder about this. It may have been a promise, but she's been keeping a secret from me for 15 years. You would think unburdening herself might lead us to a higher level of trust. That doesn't seem to be the case. I glance around the parking lot for the smoking girls, but they are long gone. Still, I feel eyes on me. I don't know whose. I don't really care. Ellie's words rip through my head like talons.
Maybe you should let this go. Maybe Mora doesn't want to be found.
What exactly am I trying to do here? Proclaiming that I'll do anything in my quest for justice sounds honorable and brave, but that doesn't make it right. How many more have to die before I step back? By flushing out Mora, am I putting her and others in danger? I'm stubborn, I'm determined, but I'm not reckless or suicidal. Should I let this go? I still feel like I'm being watched, so I turn. Someone is standing behind a tree at the Jersey Mike's subs shop down the street. Doesn't seem like a big deal, but I'm full of paranoia right now. I put my hand to the gun in my hip holster. I don't pull it. I just want to know it's there. As I step toward the tree, my phone buzzes. The number is blocked. I step toward my car.
Hello? Detective Dumas?
Yep. This is Carl Legg with the Ann Arbor Police Department. You asked me to look into finding a cardiologist named Dr. Fletcher.
Any luck?
No,
Legg says.
But there are a few things you should know. Hello, you there? I slide into my car. I'm listening.
Sorry, sounded like you cut out for a second.
So I visited Dr. Fletcher's office and spoke to the office manager.
Cassie,
yep, Legg says. You know her?
She wasn't cooperative on the phone.
She wasn't Miss Congeniality in person either, but we pushed a bit.
I appreciate that, Carl.
Brothers of the badge and all that. Anyway, Dr. Fletcher called out of the blue last week and said she was taking a sabbatical. She canceled all her appointments and transferred as many as she could to a Dr. Paul Simpson, that's her partner. I look over at the tree.
No movement. Has she done this kind of thing before?
No, according to Cassie. Dr. Fletcher is a very private person, but completely dedicated to her patients. Canceling suddenly like this was out of character. I then spoke to her husband.
What did he say?
He said they're separated and he has no idea where she is. He said she called him and said the same thing about a sabbatical. He agreed it was out of character, but he also said that since the separation she's been, and I quote, discovering herself.
I start my car and pull out of the lot. Okay, Carl, thanks. You could take it to the next level, of course, get her phone records, her credit card statements, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I might do that.
Except that means legalities, like getting warrants, and I'm not sure I want to go that route. I thank Carl Legg again and hang up. I start driving toward Augie's apartment on Oak Street. I go slow because I need to clear my head and think this through.
Augie was told Maura had gone to Ellie's that night to hide. What did that mean exactly?
I'm really not sure.
Did Augie follow up? Did he do anything with that information?
Most of all, why didn't Augie tell me?
My mobile phone rings again, and this time it's my boss, Lauren Muse.
Tomorrow morning, Muse says, 9 a.m., my office.
What's this about?
9 a.m.,
she hangs up.
Great. I wonder now if maybe one of the old-timers at the Rusty Nail did report the testicular assault on Andy Reeves. Nothing to be gained by worrying about that now. I hit Augie's number on my speed dial. No answer. I'm surprised that he hasn't called me back since I sent him a copy of Hank's videotape. The turn for Oak Street is already upon me. So much for head clearing. I pull into the lot behind the brick apartments and turn off my car. I sit and stare out the window at nothing. That doesn't help. I get out and circle toward the front of the building. The street lights are a dull amber. 100 yards ahead of me, I see an older woman walking an enormous dog. A Great Dane, maybe, something like that. I can only really see her in silhouette. When I make out what looks like a cigarette in her hand, I sigh and debate calling her out. Nah, I'm a nosy pain in the ass, but I'm not a crusader. Still, as I watch her stoop down with a plastic bag in her hand to clean up, something catches my eye. A yellow car. Or at least it looks yellow. I've seen those amber streetlights play havoc with the colors of white and cream and even certain light metallic colors. I get to the sidewalk and hurry toward it. As I rush past the older woman, I figure it won't cost me anything not to be a total hypocrite. Please don't smoke, I say. The woman just watches me rush by, which is fine by me. I've had every kind of response. One smoker was a vegan who lectured me on how my eating habits were far worse than anything tobacco and nicotine could do to me. Maybe he had a point. The car is yellow. It's also a Ford Mustang. Just like the car parked in front of the Rusty Nail. I get right up next to it and see the license plate. Ebony. Ivory. I didn't think about it before, but I get it now. Ebony and ivory. Piano terminology. This yellow Ford Mustang belongs to Andy Reeves. Again, I reach and touch my gun, not sure why. I do that sometimes. I wonder where Andy Reeves is right now. I think the answer is obvious. Augie's. I start back toward Augie's apartment. As I pass by the old woman, she says, "Thank you." Her voice is thick with phlegm. I stop. "Too late to do me any good," she says, and I see something heavy in her eyes. "But I appreciate the kindness. Keep it up." I think of several things to say, none of them in the slightest way profound, all of them ruining this moment, so I just nod and head off. This apartment development is old school and utilitarian, so there are no fancy names for the buildings. Buildings A, B, and C line the road from left to right. Buildings D, E, and F are in the row behind them. Buildings G, H, I, you get the drift. Each building houses 4 apartments, 2 on the first floor, apartments 1 and 2, 2 on the second floor, apartments 3 and 4. Augie is in building G, apartment 2. I sprint up the path and turn left. I almost run right into him. Andy Reeves is leaving Augie's apartment, his back to me, closing the door behind him. I move back down the path, out of sight. Then I realize that chances are he'll take this path and see me. I move off the pavement and duck behind a bush. When I glance at the window behind me, Building E, Apartment 1, I see a black woman with big hair staring out at me. Great. I try to smile at her reassuringly. She doesn't look reassured. I hop away and move down toward Building D. I'm not overly concerned about someone dialing 911 on me. By the time anyone responds, this will have been played out. I'm also a cop, and Augie is our captain. Andy Reeves does indeed saunter down the path where I had recently been standing. If he looks to his right, there's a slight chance he'll see me, but I'm mostly blocked by a non-functioning lamppost. I pick up my phone and hit Augie's number again. It goes right into voicemail. I don't like that. Suppose Andy Reeves has done something to Augie. Am I just going to let him go? My mind whirs. Two choices here. Check on Augie or stop Andy Reeves. Decision made. I spin around Building D and head for Augie's apartment. Here's the way I look at it. If I rush in now and find Augie... whatever. Either there will still be time to run back and catch the sauntering Andy Reeves before he gets to his car, or if not, if I get there a little late, the guy's making his escape in a neon yellow Ford Mustang. Need I say more? The windows at Augie's apartment are dark, meaning the lights are out. I don't like that either. I rush to the door and pound on it hard.
Wow, relax, it's open.
Relief courses through me. The voice belongs to Augie. I turn the knob and push the door open. No lights are on. Augie sits in the dark, with his back to me. Without turning around, he says,
What were you thinking?
About?
Did you really assault Reeves?
I might have squeezed his balls.
Jesus, are you out of your mind?
He threatened me. He threatened you too, actually.
What did he say?
That he'd kill me and everyone I loved. Augie sighs. He still hasn't turned around.
Sit down, Nap.
Can we turn a light on? This is kind of spooky. Augie reaches his hand out and flicks on a table lamp. It's not a lot of illumination, but it's enough. I move to my familiar seat and take it. Augie stays in his. How did you know about the ball grab, I ask.
Reeves was just here. He's really upset.
I bet he is. I notice now that there is a glass in Augie's hand. Augie notices me noticing.
Pour yourself one, he says.
I'm good.
That tape you sent me, he says. The ones the kids took of the copter.
What about it?
You can't show it to anybody.
No need to ask why, so I take another approach. You watched it?
Yes.
I'd love to hear your thoughts. Augie gives a heavy sigh.
A bunch of teenagers defied government no trespassing warnings and filmed the helicopter landing at a government site.
That's it?
Did I miss something?
Could you make out who was talking on the tape? I asked.
He considered that. The only voice I recognized for sure was your brother's.
How about Diana?
Augie shakes his head. Diana wasn't on the tape.
You seem pretty certain. Augie raises the glass to his lips, stops, thinks better of it, places it back down. He stares off now, beyond me and into the past.
The weekend before she died, Diana was in Philadelphia doing college tours. All three of us, Diana, Audrey, and me, were there. We visited Villanova, Swarthmore, and Haverford. We liked them all, though Diana thought Haverford might be too small and Villanova might be too big. When we got home on Sunday, she was deciding between two colleges for early decision, Swarthmore and Amherst, which we'd visited over the summer.
He still looks off, his voice devoid of any emotion.
If Diana made that decision, she never got the chance to tell me. Both applications were on her desk on the night she died.
Now he takes a deep pull from his drink. I give it a moment. Augie, they were covering something up at the base. I expect a denial, but he nods.
Seems so.
You're not surprised?
That a remote government agency protected by barbed wire fencing was a cover? No, Nap. I'm not surprised.
I assume Andy Reeves asked you about the tape, I say.
Yes,
and?
He said I should make sure you don't release it. He said that it would be tantamount to treason, that it was a matter of national security.
It has to be connected to Leo and Diana. He closes his eyes and shakes his head. Come on, Augie. They discover this secret, and a week later they end up dead.
No, Augie says, it's not connected. At least not like you say.
Are you for real? You think this is all a giant coincidence? Augie looks down into his drink as though there really is an answer at the bottom of it.
You're a great investigator, Knapp. I don't say that just because I trained you. Your mind, you're brilliant in many ways. You see things others can't. But sometimes you need to go back to the basics, to what you definitely know. Stop taking leaps. Look at the facts. Look at what we know for certain.
I wait.
Number one, Leo and Diana were found dead by railroad tracks miles away from the military base.
I can explain that. He raises a hand to stop me.
I'm sure you can. I'm sure you'll tell me that they could have been moved or whatever. But right now, let me just state the facts, no maybes.
He raises a finger.
Fact one. Their bodies were found miles from the military base. Fact two.
A second finger.
The medical examiner concluded that blunt trauma from a moving train caused their deaths, nothing else. Before I continue, are we clear on all this?
I nod, not because I completely agree. A train strike is devastating and might disguise earlier trauma, but because I want to hear what else he has to say.
Now let's examine this tape you found. Assuming it is authentic, and I see no reason to think it's not. 1 week before these deaths, one of the deceased, Leo, saw a helicopter over the base. Your theory, I assume, is that this led to his death. Keep in mind that Diana wasn't with them when they made this video.
Leo would have told her, I counter.
No, he said. No? Again, stick with the evidence, Knapp. If you stick with the evidence, you'll conclude, as I have, that Diana never knew.
I'm not following, I say.
It's simple. He meets my eyes. Did Leo tell you about the helicopter?
I open my mouth and stop. I see where he is going with this. I slowly shake my head.
How about your girlfriend, Maura? She was on the tape, am I correct?
Yes.
Did Maura tell you?
No, I say. Augie lets that sink in before continuing.
And then we have the toxicology report.
I know what the report said. Hallucinogenics, alcohol, and pot in their systems. What about it, I ask. Augie is trying to sound analytical, trying to be just the facts, ma'am, but his voice is coarse from the pain.
You knew my daughter for a long time.
Yes. You could even say you were friends.
Yes. In fact,
now he sounds a bit like an attorney during a cross-examination.
You set Diana and Leo up.
That's not exactly accurate. I brought them together. I didn't actively set them up. But this hardly seems the time to argue semantics. What's your point, Augie?
All fathers are naive when it comes to their little girls. I was no different, I guess. I thought the sun rose and set on that girl. Diana played soccer in the fall. She was a cheerleader in the winter. She was an active leader in a dozen extracurricular activities.
He leans forward into the light.
I'm a cop, not a fool. I know none of that means your kid won't do drugs or get into any trouble. But would you say Diana was a big partier?
I don't really have to think about the answer.
No. No, he repeats. And ask Ellie. Ask her how often Diana did drugs or drank before...
He stops himself. His eyes close.
And yet that night, when Leo comes to pick her up, I'm there. I answer the door for him. I shake his hand. And I can see it.
See what?
He's stoned. Not for the first time. I want to say something. I want to stop her from going out the door. But Diana just gives me this pleading look, you know the one, like, don't make a scene, Dad. So I don't. I let her go.
He's there as he says this, shaking hands with you, looking at his daughter, seeing the expression on her face, that what if, that regret, never leaves him.
So now that we got the facts out, Nap, you tell me, what's more likely? A big conspiracy involving CIA agents that, I don't know, kidnapped two kids because one of them had filmed a helicopter the week before? If the CIA knew about that, why did they wait a week before they killed him? Dragged them both across town to railroad tracks and, I guess, pushed them in front of a speeding train? Or is the more likely scenario that a girl went out with a boy who liked to get high and stoned? They partied too hard, they remembered the legend of Jimmy Riccio, and together, flying high, tried to jump the track. Just fell a little short.
He looks at me and waits. You're leaving a whole lot of stuff out, I say.
No, Nap. You're putting a whole lot of stuff in.
We have Rex. We have Hank, 15 years later. And you know Maura hid that night. Ellie told you about it. Why didn't you tell me?
When should I have told you? You were an 18-year-old kid. Should I have told you when you were 19? When you graduated from the academy? When you got promoted to county? When should I have told you something as irrelevant as your old girlfriend didn't want to go home so she stayed with Ellie?
Is he for real? Maura was scared and hiding, I say, trying not to shout, from something that happened on the night Leo and Diana were killed. He shakes his head.
You need to leave this alone. For everyone's sake.
Yeah, I keep hearing that.
I love you, Nap. I mean that, I love you.
No, I won't say like a son.
That would be too presumptuous.
It would also be an insult to what you had with your dad, a wonderful guy I miss very much. And it would be an insult to my little girl. But I do love you. I tried hard to be a good mentor to you, a good friend. You have been that and more. Augie leans back, his drink is empty. He puts it on the side table.
Neither of us has many people left we care about. I couldn't stand it if something happened. You're young, Nap. You're smart. You're kind and you're generous and... shit. Starting to sound like one of those online dating profiles.
He smiles now. I smile back.
You need to move on. Whatever the answer, you're messing with some very dangerous people. They'll hurt you. They'll hurt me. You heard Reeves. He'll hurt anybody you care about. Let's say you're right and I'm wrong. Let's say they saw something and, I don't know, they killed Diana and Leo. Why? To silence them, I guess. And now let's say they waited 15 years. Why did they wait? Again, I don't know. But then they hired a hitman to put two bullets in the back of Rex's head. And they slaughter Hank and conveniently pin it on a viral video. Does all that really sound more logical than my theory about them getting high? I don't know. Maybe. But let's say that Reeves and his henchmen are all that horrible and dangerous and they've killed that many people. Let's say your theory is true, okay?
I nod.
Forget you and me, Nap. You don't think they'll go after Ellie to stop us? Or her two girls?
I picture Leah and Kelsey. I see their smiling faces, hear them, feel their arms wrap around me. That slows me down. I was heading down this hill at a carefree breakneck pace, but Augie's words forced me to pull back on the reins a little. I try to remember what I told myself earlier. Don't act in haste. Think and consider.
It's late, Augie says. Nothing more is going to happen tonight. Go to sleep. Let's talk in the morning.
Chapter 24. I head home, but there is no way I'm going to sleep. I think about what Augie said about the possibility of danger to Ellie and the girls, and I'm not sure what to do about that. It is easy to say that I can't be intimidated, but one has to be pragmatic, too. What are the odds I'll actually solve the case? Long shot. What are the odds not only that I'll learn the truth about Leo and Diana, but that I'll also find enough evidence to bring someone up on charges, never mind get a conviction? Longer shot. And to the contrary, what are the odds that I or someone close to me suffers terrible consequences because of my blind determination to complete this mission? The question is practically rhetorical. Is it worth poking the bear? I don't know for sure. The wise thing may indeed be to let it go. You're dead, Leo. Whatever I do now, no matter what horror I unearth, that will not change. You will still be dead and gone. Intellectually, I know this. And yet... I open the internet browser on my laptop. I put in Andy Reeves' name, the state of New Jersey, and then I add the word piano. I get a hit. Welcome to the fan page for Piano Man Andy. Fan page. I click on the link. Yes, Andy Reeves, like almost every performer, has his own website. The homepage features a portrait of him in soft focus, wearing what looks like a sequined blazer. World-renowned pianist Andy Reeves is a gifted vocalist, a comedian, and the all-around entertainer nicknamed by those who love him, the Other Piano Man. Good boy. I skim down. Andy occasionally does high-end private parties such as weddings, corporate events, birthdays, and bar bat mitzvahs. A burst in the middle of the page reads, "Want to join the Other Piano Man fan club? Stay in touch via our newsletter." Below that, there's a place to type in my email. I demur. Down the left side of the page, the buttons read Home, Bio, Photos, Song Lists, Schedule. I click Schedule. I scan down until I find today. His gig at the Rusty Nail is listed until 6 p.m. Beneath that, it shows he'll be playing at a club called Hunka Hunka from 10 p.m. until midnight. My phone buzzes. It's a text from Ellie. "You awake?" My thumbs start going. "It's only 10. Yes. "Want to go for a quick walk?" "Sure. Want me to swing by?" The little dots are moving. Then Ellie's message appears. "I'm already walking. Meet me at the BF lot." I pull into the empty middle school lot 5 minutes later. Ellie and Bob don't live far from here. Like most school lots, this one is lit up pretty well, but I don't see her. I park and get out of the car. "Over here." There's a classic school playground out on the left. Swings, slides, climbing walls, nets, ladders, monkey bars, all floored by soft mulch. Ellie sits on a swing. She's pushing herself with her feet, but only a little, so the effect is more like a comforting rocking than anything in the swing family. The cedar smell from the mulch gets stronger as I walk toward her. "You okay?" I ask. Ellie nods. "I just didn't want to go home yet." I'm not sure what to say to this, so I settle for a nod. "Ah, I loved playgrounds when I was a kid," Ellie says. "Do you remember the game Foursquare?" "No," I say. "Never mind, I'm being silly." "I come here a lot, though." "To this playground?" She nods. "At night." "I'm not sure why." I take the swing next to her. "I didn't know." "Yeah, we are learning a lot about each other," Ellie says. I think about that. "Not really."
"What do you mean?"
"You know everything about me, Ellie. Just because I never told you about beating Trey, well, you knew it was me." She nods.
"I did. And the other times.
With Roscoe and Brandon, and I forget Alicia's boyfriend's name."
"Colin."
"Right. So, you know everything about me. Everything.
The implication being that you don't know everything about me?
I don't reply.
Fair enough, Ellie says. I don't tell you everything.
You don't trust me?
You know better.
So?
So I'm allowed my secrets. I shouldn't have told you about Bob, because now you'll hate him and think about hurting him.
A little, I confess.
She smiles. Don't. You don't get it. He's the same man you admired this morning.
I don't agree, but I don't see any point in voicing that.
Ellie stares up at the night sky. There are a handful of stars out, but feels like there should be more. I heard from Maura's mom. The guy in the picture you sent? It's the same man who interrogated her. The pale guy with the whispery voice.
I'm not surprised. I saw him earlier today.
Who is he?
His name is Andy Reeves. I gesture with my chin toward the path. He ran the military base when Leo and Diana were killed.
You talked to him?
I nod.
Did he say anything?
He threatened to kill everyone I love. I just look at her.
Another person who suggests you let it go, Ellie says.
Suggests? She shrugs. But, yes, joining you and Augie.
Augie? There's someone else you love.
I nod.
Are you considering it?
What, dropping the case?
Yes.
I am.
Ellie looks back toward the path, her eyes narrow.
What, I ask.
I may reconsider.
Meaning?
I don't think you can drop this now.
I can if it puts you or the girls at risk.
No. It's just the opposite.
I'm not following, I say.
I know I was the one who said you should let it go. But that was before this creepy guy threatened my kids. Now I don't want to let it go. If we do, he'll always be out there. I'll always be looking over my shoulder.
If I let it go, he won't bother you.
Right, Ellie says with a scoff. Tell that to Rex and Hank.
I could argue that Rex and Hank posed a more direct threat, that they were actual eyewitnesses to that helicopter hovering over the base 15 years ago, but I don't think it would matter. I get what she's saying. Ellie doesn't want to live in fear. She wants me to take care of it, and she doesn't want to know how.
Ellie pushes with her legs harder now. The swing goes back, and, using the momentum, she gracefully jumps off as it comes forward, even triumphantly raising her hands like a gymnast, sticking the landing. I care so much about her, and yet for the first time I'm realizing I still don't know her. That's making me care all the more.
I won't let anything happen to you, I say.
I know.
I remember the schedule I'd seen a little earlier on the Andy the Other Piano Man website. He'll be at the Hunka Hunka Club, whatever that is. I'll go there and confront him tonight.
One more thing, Ellie says.
What?
I may have a lead on Beth Lashley's whereabouts. When we were in high school, her parents bought a small organic farm in Far Hills. My cousin Merle has a place down there. I asked her to drive by and just knock on the door. She said she tried, but the gate by the fence was locked.
Could be nothing.
Could be. I'll take a little drive tomorrow and let you know.
Thank you.
Sure.
Ellie lets loose a deep breath and looks over at the school. Does it seem that long ago when we went to this school? I look with her. A lifetime ago, I say. Ellie gives that one a small chuckle.
I better head back. You want me to drive you?
No,
she says. I'd rather walk.
Chapter 25. Hunka Hunka advertises itself as an upscale review of male erotic dancers for ladies with class, because no one says strip joint anymore. Tonight's featured performer is Dick Shaftwood, which I suspect may be a pseudonym. I find the yellow Ford Mustang tucked in a back corner of the club parking lot. There's no point in going inside, so I park in a spot where I can clearly see the exits and the Mustang. I notice two buses and several large vans in the lot, like maybe tour groups come here. What I learned from watching the crowd enter and exit is somewhat obvious. Women don't come here alone. I don't see one woman walk in or out by herself, like guys do at their strip clubs. The female clientele here come in groups, usually large ones, all cheering and already at least partially lubed up. Most, if not all, seem to be with bachelorette parties, which explains the buses and large vans. They are being responsible, good, clean, dirty fun, with a professional designated driver. It's getting late. The women departing now are annoyingly hammered, loud, staggering, sloppy, falling over one another, holding one another up, but staying close together in a pack, waiting for any straggler to rejoin the herd before proceeding onward. A few of the male strippers start heading home. Even fully clothed, they are not hard to pick out. They all scowl. They all have that stick-up-the-ass, yo-brah strut. Most are wearing loose-fitting flannel shirts barely buttoned, their waxed cleavage glistening in the streetlight. I can't imagine why Hunka Hunka would need a piano player, but a quick check of the website on my phone, Hunka Hunka has its own app, by the way, shows that they offer themed events, including some kind of classy experience involving dancers and tails moving to old classics on a Steinway grand piano. I'm not in the judging business, Leo. It's just past midnight when Andy Reeves, decked out in a tux, makes his exit. There's no reason to play it coy or cute here. I get out of my car and start toward his. When Reeves sees me, he looks less than pleased. "What are you doing here, Dumas?" "Call me by my nom de plume," I say. "Dick Shaftwood." He doesn't find that funny.
"How did you find me?"
"Your newsletter. I'm a card-carrying member of the Other Piano Man fan club." Reeves doesn't find this funny either. He picks up his pace.
"I got nothing to say to you."
Then, thinking of it,
"Unless you brought me the tape."
"I didn't," I say. "But I've kind of had enough, Andy."
"Meaning?"
"Meaning, you either talk to me, or I email out that tape right now." I hold out my phone, as though my thumb is poised over a send button. It's a bluff. I start with a friend of mine at the Washington Post and move on from there. Reeves shoots daggers at me with his eyes. I sigh.
"Fine, then."
I pretend to get ready to push the send button.
"Wait."
My thumb stays poised and ready.
"If I tell you the truth about the base,
do I have your word you'll let this go?" "Yes," I say. He takes a step toward me.
"I need you to swear on the memory of your brother."
It is a mistake for him to bring you into this, but I do indeed swear. I could voice caveats. I could tell him that if he or his cohorts had something to do with your death, not only would I sing like an oversharing canary, but I would personally be certain to take each and every one of them down. I don't worry about the swearing. If what he tells me now needs to be revealed, I'll do so with joy and enthusiasm.
"Okay,"
Andy Reeves says.
"Let's go somewhere and talk."
"I'm good right here." He glances around the lot in full suspicion mode. There are a few stragglers, but this is hardly a hotbed of potential eavesdroppers. Still, he probably spent most of his life working in some kind of clandestine governmental department, CIA or something, so I get the paranoia.
"Let's at least get in my car," Reeves suggests.
I snatch the car key from his hand and slide into the passenger seat. Then he gets into the driver's. We both face forward now. Our view is of an old stockade fence that has seen better days. Several wooden pickets are either missing or cracked, like a vagrant's teeth after too many fistfights. "I'm waiting," I say.
"We weren't part of the Department of Agriculture," he says.
When he doesn't go on, I say, "Yeah, I kind of figured that."
"Then the rest of this is simple. What happened in that facility is highly classified. You know that now. I'm confirming it. That should be enough."
"And yet it's not," I say.
"We had nothing to do with your brother or Diana Stiles."
I give him my best get-to-the-point expression. Andy Reeves makes a big deal of considering his next move. He makes me promise yet again to never speak a word of this to anyone, not ever. That he will deny it, that nothing he says leaves this car. You get the drift. I agree with all of it, so we can move on.
"You know the time period we are talking about," Andy Reeves begins. 15 years ago, Post 9/11, Iraq War, Al-Qaeda, all of that. You need to put this in that context.
Okay.
Do you remember a man named Terry Freemond?
I searched the memory banks. I do.
Rich white kid from a Chicago suburb who got turned into a terrorist. Uncle Sam Al-Qaeda, they called him, something like that. He was on the FBI top 10 list.
He still is,
Andy Reeves explains. 15 years ago, Freemond set up a terrorist cell when he came back home. They were close to pulling off what may have been the worst event on U.S. soil, perhaps in history. Another 9/11.
Andy Reeves turns and meets my eye.
Do you recall the official story of what happened to him?
He got wind the feds were onto him, escaped through Canada, and made his way back to Syria or Iraq.
Yes,
Andy Reeves says slowly and with great care.
That is the official story.
Reeves just keeps staring at me. I think about the orange blur that I assumed was a jumpsuit. I think about the secure location. I think about the need for secrecy. I think about the helicopter coming in at night under the cover of darkness and silence. You guys captured him. You brought him to the base.
We had all heard the rumors back then, hadn't we? I remember something else now, Leo. Something you told me, but I don't remember when. We had to be in high school. You were fascinated by what the media had then labeled the War on Terror. You told me about them, harsh, dark places overseas, where they took enemy combatants to make them talk. Not to regular POW camps, but to the base, I say out loud. It was a black site.
Andy Reeves looks back out the front windshield again.
We had black sites in countries like Afghanistan, Lithuania, Thailand. Places with code names like the Salt Pit and Bright Light and the Quartz.
His voice fades out.
There's one CIA prison on an island in the Indian Ocean. One used to be a horse-riding school. One was even a storefront, hiding in plain sight. They were crucial in our fight on terrorism. It was where our military would hold high-value foreign detainees for the purposes of enhanced interrogation.
Enhanced interrogation.
It made sense keeping them in these foreign countries, Reeves continues. Most of our enemy combatants were foreigners, so why bring them here? The legal technicalities are complicated, but if you interrogate an enemy combatant off American soil, the laws can be, shall we say, finessed. And you can be for or against enhanced interrogation, that's fine. I don't care. But don't comfort yourself in the lie that it didn't get us good intel or save lives. It did. That's the moral out people give themselves, isn't it? I'm against torture, they say. Oh, yeah? Suppose beating up a monster who slaughtered thousands would save your child's life. Would you do it? And they can't answer. They can't say, sure, I'll sacrifice my own child for my moral stand, so they come up with a smug rationalization like, it doesn't work anyway.
Andy Reeves turns, and his look is as heavy as the ages.
Torture works. That's the horror of it.
I feel the chill, sitting in this dark car alone with this man, even as he is warming up to the tale. I've seen this before. It is so terrible a secret, so horrible a confession. And yet once you feel free to unburden yourself, once you let go and start talking, the sense of relief makes your mouth go into free fall.
The problem was an obvious one. Forget overseas. There were, still are, terror cells right here in the United States. More than you can imagine. Most are American citizens, pathetic nihilists, who get off on violence and mass destruction. But if we arrest them here in the United States, they have rights and due process and attorneys and all that. They wouldn't talk. And maybe, just maybe, a big attack is imminent.
So you'd grab a suspect, I say. You'd stick them on a stealth helicopter, you'd take them to that base, you'd interrogate them.
Can you imagine a better place for a site like that?
I say nothing.
The detainees, they never stayed with us long. We used to call the base purgatory. From there we could decide to let you go to heaven, or send you overseas to hell.
And how would you determine that? Reeves turns and looks right through me, That's all the answer he is going to give, and that's all the answer I need. Now get to the part about my brother, I say.
There is no part with your brother. That's the end of the story.
No, my friend, it's not. I now know that he and his friends made a tape of an American citizen being illegally held.
His face darkens. We saved lives.
Not my brother's, I say. Not Diana's.
We had nothing to do with that. I didn't even know about a tape until you showed it to me.
I tried to read his face for the lie, but Andy Reeves is no amateur. Still, I don't see deception there.
Did Reeves not know about the tape? How could that be?
I have one last card to play, and I play it.
If you didn't know about the tape, I say, why were you looking for Maura? Who?
This time the lie is easy to spot. I make a face. You questioned her mother, I say.
More than that. I think you, what, took her to your little black site, did something so she'd forget whatever you did to her there? I don't know what you're talking about.
I showed her your picture, Andy. She confirmed that it was you who interrogated her. He stares back at the front windshield and slowly shakes his head.
You don't understand a thing.
Our deal was you come clean, I say. If you're just going to jerk me around...
Open the glove compartment, he says.
What? Andy Reeves sighs.
Just open the glove compartment, okay?
I reach toward the glove compartment, turning my head for just a second to find a button to open it. But that is enough. His fist, I assume it's his fist because I never see it, lands square in the spot between my left temple and cheekbone. The impact knocks my head to the right and rattles my teeth. Numbness runs down my cheek and into my neck. He digs his hand into the glove compartment. My head is still swimming, but one thought makes its way to the surface. Gun. He's going for a gun. His hand is grasping something metallic. Can't make it out. But do I really need to? I get enough of my bearings to grab his wrist with both of my hands. This leaves both of my hands occupied, while one of his remains free. He uses that hand now to pummel me with short punches to my ribs. I don't let go. He starts turning and twisting his wrist, trying to break free, or maybe... Yes, he's trying to angle the muzzle toward me. I slide one of my hands down far enough to cover his fingers. None are on a trigger. I press down hard now. He can angle the gun, but without a finger on a trigger, he can't hurt. That's what I'm thinking right now. I have his fingers, so he can't shoot me. I'm safe. And that thinking ends up being tragically wrong. He twists one more time. For a second, I feel the cold metal hit the top of my hand, but only for a second. I see now that it's not a gun. It's too long. It's in the shape of a baton. I hear the crackle of electricity and feel the pain at the same time. The kind of pain that closes down everything else, that makes you recoil to avoid any more of it. The volt runs up my arm, rendering it useless. Andy Reeves easily pulls his wrist free of my now non-existent grip. Then, with a gleeful smile, he pushes the device, a stun baton, electric cattle prod, I don't know, against my torso. I start to convulse. He does it again. My muscles won't work anymore. He reaches into the back seat and pulls out something else. I can't see what it is. A tire iron, maybe. A baseball bat, I don't know. I'll never know. He hits me in the head with it once, then again. And then there's nothing. Chapter 26. I swim my way to consciousness in the strangest way. Do you know the dreams where you can't do the smallest of physical tasks? You try to run from danger, but it's like every step is a trudge through wet snow at hip height. I was feeling something like that now. I wanted to move, to run, to escape. But I was frozen in place like my whole body was encased in heavy lead. When I blink my eyes open, I'm lying on my back. I see pipes and exposed beams, a ceiling, an old basement. I try to stay cool, calm, not make any sudden moves. I try to turn my head to take in my surroundings. But I can't. I can't move my head at all. Not half an inch. It feels like there is a vice locking my skull in place. I struggle and try harder. No go. No give at all. I try to sit up, but I'm strapped to some kind of table. My arms are belted against my sides. My legs are wrapped up tight. I can't move at all. I'm completely helpless. Reeves' whispery voice says,
"You need to tell me where the tape is, Nap."
Conversation won't work here. I know that right away. So without saying a word, I scream for help. I scream as loud as I can. I keep screaming until he jams a gag in my mouth.
"Pointless," he says.
Reeves is performing some kind of task. He's humming as he does it, but I can't move my head to see. I hear the sound of a faucet being turned on, of someone filling a bucket or something. Then the faucet goes off.
"Do you know why Navy SEALs stopped using waterboarding as part of their training?" Reeves asks.
When I don't answer, can't answer with the gag in my mouth, he says,
"Because the trainee would crack so fast it was bad for morale. CIA recruits lasted an average of 14 seconds before they begged their instructor to stop."
Andy Reeves stands over me. I look up at his smiling face, and I can see he's enjoying this.
"We would play an entire psychology game with the detainee, too. A blindfold, having him escorted in by armed guards. Sometimes we would offer him hope and crush it. Sometimes we would let him know that there was no escape. You play it different ways, depending on the subject. But I don't have time for those theatrics tonight, Nap. I feel bad about Diana, I really do, but that wasn't my fault. So we move on. You're already strapped to the table. You already know this is going to be very bad."
He moves toward my feet. My eyes try to follow, but he's out of sight now. I try not to panic. I hear something cranking, and now I realize that the table I'm on is starting to tilt. I hope maybe I'll slip right off the table, even onto my head, but I'm strapped so tightly gravity doesn't shift me even a little.
"Inclining your head and raising your feet," he explains, "keeps the throat open and makes filling the nostrils with water easier. You are imagining this is going to be awful. It is going to be much worse."
He moves back into view and pulls the gag from my mouth.
"Are you going to tell me where the tape is?"
"I'll show you," I say.
"No, that won't do.
You can't get to it on your own."
"That's a lie. I've heard all this before, Detective Dumas. You'll make up a story now. You'll probably make up new stories the first time or two I take you through this process. That's why critics call torture unreliable. You're desperate. You'll say anything for a reprieve. But that won't work with me. I know all the tricks. Eventually, you will crack. Eventually, you will tell me the truth."
"Maybe. But I know one thing for certain. Once he has the tape, he'll kill me. The same as he killed the others. So no matter what, I can't give in." As if he can read my mind, he says,
"You'll tell me, even if it means your death." A soldier who interrogated prisoners in the Philippine-American War once described what you're about to experience this way. His suffering must be that of a man who is drowning, but cannot drown.
Andy Reeves shows me the towel.
"Ready?"
Then he places it against my entire face, blinding me. The towel is just lying on my face, not even being held down tightly, but I already feel as though I'm suffocating a little. I try to move my head again, but it still won't budge. My chest starts to hitch. "Calm down," I tell myself. I try to do that. I try to slow my breathing and prepare. I know that I'll need to hold my breath at some point. Seconds pass. Nothing happens. My breathing doesn't become more regular. It stays jangled and uneven. I strain to hear something, anything, but Andy Reeves isn't speaking or moving or doing anything. More time passes. How long? 30 seconds? 40 seconds? Maybe this is all a bluff, I start to think. Maybe this is just a psychological game, a way to stress. That's when I hear the splash. A second later, no more, water starts to seep through the towel. When I feel the wet,